Now, this evening, I'm going to take the time to work through two chapters slowly, even though that'll slow us down a bit. We are going to go through chapters 13 and 14 with some care. And to be honest, that means we're not going to have much time for 15 and 16. We'll just sketch them in next week before we press on to other things. But I think it's important here to go slowly for a bit. And in fact, some of what we do this week will cover some of the material in 17 in any case. So we're really tonight looking at 13, 14, and parts of 17. And then we'll stay with the syllabus, God willing, next week. Chapter 12, if you recall, introduced the woman and the dragon, and the dragon is clearly identified for us as the devil. Now, in chapter 13, you find first the beast out of the sea, and then second the beast out of the earth, and we'll take them step by step. Rather than reading the whole chapter, let me begin by reading just the first part, the beast out of the sea. Remember, too, where we are, in that chapter 12 pictures the dragon, the devil, being thrown out of heaven, and in consequence, no longer having any access to God, and in a fury because, first, his regime has been restricted, second, because his time is short, third, because he can't do anything with the son of the woman, and therefore is enraged against the woman, is venting his spleen against the church. We've seen that. You must remember that that is the context in which all this is set, you see? And so he's pursuing the woman who is in the desert, a place both of trial and of some protection. And the dragon now stands on the shore of the sea. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with a sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Now we saw last week that the beast, the dragon, the devil, goes after the woman during 1,260 days, or 42 months, or 3.5 years, time times and half a time. That is an extended period of suffering which the Lord in his mercy cut short. But Satan does not work in isolation. The point of this passage, chapter 13, is that he operates commonly through two agents. Through these two agents, Satan carries out his wretched war on God's people. The beast out of the sea is a grotesque seven-headed monster. And then we'll see the beast out of the earth, less terrifying a spectacle, but given to great deceptions. So, right now, in the first part, I want to focus on the beast out of the sea so that we may better learn the nature of our opposition. I shall divide what I have to say in this first part into 5 points. Number one, the power of Satan expresses itself in antichrists, plural, in concrete historical opposition to God's people. Let me repeat that. The power of Satan expresses itself in antichrists, plural, in concrete historical opposition to God's people. Now, the ancient world commonly thought of the sea as evil, or at least a symbol for evil, especially amongst non-seafaring peoples like the Jews. We'll look at concrete references a little later on in the series. But a beast out of the sea, then, suggests a beast out of this depth of chaos. If you're traveling on an oil tanker, you can sometimes go through parts of the sea that seem perfectly smooth, just wonderful. But for anybody living by the seashore, a land people living by the sea is always moving. The tide's either coming in or it's going out. It is always restless. It is always restless. It never stops. This is the source of chaos. This is the source of movement. This is the source of confusion. You see again and again. You can understand that. So a beast coming out of the sea reflects the same chaos, mobility, threat. This sort of source for the beast is typical enough of apocalyptic literature, mixing the metaphors. The beast comes out of the abyss in chapter 11, verse 7, chapter 17, verse 8. Here this beast nevertheless comes out of the sea. Now then, 10 horns and 7 heads. Here, before we press on any further, it is important to remember what I've mentioned before, that often apocalyptic will introduce something and then explain it in a later passage, or at least enlarge upon it in a later passage, or put into a larger framework. And in this particular case, a great deal about this beast reoccurs in chapter 17, verses 8 and following. So while you keep your finger in chapter 13, turn to chapter 17, if you will. And we're going to be flipping back and forth. In chapter 17, you find a woman again, but this is quite a different woman. This is the woman on the beast. And the woman turns out to be mystery, verse 5, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. This woman is drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. John is greatly astonished, verse 6. The angel, who's still interpreting things for John, says, why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. And thus this beast is identified as the beast that has just been introduced to us back in chapter 13. It's the only one in the whole book like this. Okay? So in other words, we know we're talking now about the same beast. Now listen to what is said. It's very important. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Out of the abyss or out of the sea, it's the same difference, mixing of metaphors. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for mind with wisdom. Well, I should say so. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. What is that going to mean in the ancient world? Yet they are also 7 kings. You got your mingling of metaphors again. 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is. The other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to his destruction. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom. But who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast? They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Now then, what does all this mean? We'll be going back and forth here just a bit. Note several details still under the first point. A. Was, now is not, and will come out of the abyss, chapter 17, 8. Now, at one level, this is a parody of the Lamb. God, or God and the Lamb, are constantly said to be the one who was and is to come. The language is redolent of the other. But the beast doesn't quite make it. He was, now is not, and is to come. On the face of it, this suggests that the beast is that satanically inspired power that, however he's understood historically, we'll worry about that in a moment, having received a stroke of death, chapter 13, he's received a fatal wound, nevertheless returns to hurl himself with renewed fury against the forces of God. Look at chapter 13 again. We'll go back and forth. Chapter 13, verse 3. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound. But the fatal wound had been healed. Verse 12. Now here you're really talking about the beast of the earth, but this beast of the earth looks back on the other beast. This beast from the earth, verse 12, exercised all the authority of the first beast, that's the beast from the sea, on his behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. Do you hear the language there? Doesn't it make you sit up and take notice? You can speak of a wound that has been healed, and you can speak of a fatal wound. But how can you speak of a fatal wound that has been healed? Do you see? It is purposely incongruous. And the reason why it's incongruous is bound up with the fact that in chapter 17, he appears as the one who was and is not, because he was killed. He received a fatal wound. And yet will be. That is, this beast comes, attacks, receives a fatal wound, and then disappears because of it, and then comes back again. In other words, it's the beast who, as it were, keeps on coming out of the abyss and out of the sea. Now, it's very important to see that the language is drawn from the vision of Daniel 7. The language especially of chapter 13, verse 2. Daniel 7, there are four great beasts. The lion there represents Babylon. The bear, Media. The leopard, Persia. And the fourth beast is Greece. And the ten horns coming out of Greece are, as far as I can see, the Seleucid kings that lead up. See, they follow out of Alexander the Great of Greece, and they lead out of the Greek Empire all the way to the terrible little horn, which is Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Who is in control when you have the 3.5 years? I mentioned all of that last week, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and the 3.5 years from 167 to 164 B.C., when they were made it a capital offense to observe the Sabbath or have any copy of Scripture, and so on, so on, so on. All of this is past when John writes, but the beast is still here. He was, he is not, and he is to come. If I mistake not, this beast recurs throughout history. He is Antiochus Epiphanes, but he's also Nero. He's the whole Roman Caesar institution which tries to destroy the church. Hence, the woman is the harlot sitting on the seven hills. The seven and the tens get mixed up in different ways. So the seven, the figure seven, the seven horns, the seven heads rather, are also identified in chapter 17 as the seven hills. What would that mean to anybody living in the ancient world? What would it mean to anybody living in Europe today? It couldn't mean anything other than the Roman power. The beast is also Pope Innocent III and Mao Zedong. You see, at John's time of writing, he is not clearly manifest. Now is not. When you read the seven letters, you see that, yes, there has been a recent martyr, Antipas, but it's not as if there are huge strings of people going off. They see that there's more martyrdom coming around the corner, but to mention, yes, there has been one recently, and meanwhile, two or three of the churches are having a wonderful time, thank you very much. Sir, they're certainly not facing martyrdom. Look at Laodicea. It's having a wonderful time. You see, there's not emperor-wide persecution going on when John is writing, but he sees it's coming around the corner. Now is not. But he comes back again. He surfaces again and again and again. B, in John's specific context, then, the major opposition to the church is certainly connected with the Roman Empire. Hence 17, 9, and 10. The seven hills on which the harlot is sitting is clearly Rome, the city built on seven hills. Rome began, of course, as seven settlements on the seven hills of the left bank of the Tiber River. But it becomes the epitome of all opposition to the church in John's day. And then there's another mix of metaphors. The seven also equals seven kings, we're told. Five are fallen, one is, and what is yet to come. Now, what does that mean? The short answer is, I don't know. But there's a longer answer. The reason I don't know is not because there are no possibilities. It's because there are two or three possibilities, and I don't know quite which one works best. The simplest solution would be that John is locating himself in Roman history so that the seven kings are seven Caesars or something like that. The trouble is the various solutions don't work very well. The most common one that's offered is this. First, Augustus Caesar, who's around when Jesus is born. Then Tiberius Caesar, who's around when Jesus ministers. Then Caligula. I don't know if you watched I, Claudius, on PBS television a few years ago when it was on. Caligula was the one who was mad, the one who claimed that he was God and then deified his horse. He really was mad. Fourth, Claudius of I. Claudius fame. Fifth, Nero. Sixth, Vespasian, who now is, which would presuppose that this was written about AD 70 when Vespasian was on the throne. And Titus then becomes the one to come. That's often suggested. The problem is, first, the first Caesar wasn't really Augustus, it was really Julius. As in Julius Caesar and Shakespeare and all that. Second, it's a slimmed down list, because there were three quick emperors in the year of the four emperors, it was called, in AD 70. Gallo, Otho, and Vitellius, between Nero and Vespasian. And then, in addition, in my view, it's more likely that Revelation was written in Domitian's reign, after Titus, about AD 93 or thereabouts, 94, not in Vespasian's. I'm just not quite sure. It may be that 7, which is so often used in John as a number to symbolize completeness, means 7. It means that John sees in the seven kings the power of the Roman Empire as a whole. Part of it is past, 5 kings, part of it is present, the 6th, and part of it is still to come. I'm not sure. In any case, this brings us to the third element in the interpretation of the beast, and this is what is perhaps most important for us. There is more to come beyond the Roman Empire. Look at chapter 17, verse 11. You've been told in chapter 13 that he's got 7 heads. You've had the harlot riding the beast identified with Rome. And then, suddenly, you are told, verse 11, the beast who once was and now is not, clearly we're talking about the same beast, is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to his destruction. Now what is going on there? You have this whole thing nicely wrapped up with 10 horns and 7 heads and so on, and suddenly, bang, in comes another one. The beast himself, we're told, is an 8th king who belongs to the 7 and yet succeeds them. He's an 8th. He belongs to them in some sense and yet he succeeds them in another. What do you do with that? Well, I'll tell you what I think. I know it's disputed. But if I mistake not, this is tied to another Johannine writing. In 1 John chapter 2, a passage that I mentioned the first night, we are told in verse 18-19, my dear children, it is the last hour. And as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, even so also now there are already many Antichrists, plural. Antichrists, plural. In other words, the arrival of Christ ensures also the arrival of Antichrist. Until finally, in the new heaven and the new earth, there's no more opposition. The assumption of the language in 1 John 2 is that there is an ultimate Antichrist to come, but that in anticipation of his coming, there are already many Antichrists who come along. I think that is what is meant here. You see, once you've identified the 7 heads as the 7 hills of Rome, you bind it up with the Roman Empire. But then if you start mentioning an 8th, doesn't it sound as if you're going beyond the Roman Empire? And there are only 7 hills, not 8. John is careful enough from his point of view that at the end of the day, he doesn't want to make the Roman Empire the sum total of all the active historical opposition against the people of God. The 8th belongs to the 7, that is, in the sense that he plays the same sort of role as the 7. But of course he's an 8th, which puts him beyond. That suggests, I think, that his period, finally, is a time of special evil, the time of the Antichrist, before the return of the Messiah. So now if you go back to Revelation chapter 13, the beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. Now, clearly, this is not quite the same use of the symbolism that you find in Daniel 7. We've already seen that that's the way the Old Testament is quoted again and again and again. It picks up some of the language from the Old Testament, but twists it another way. In other words, what this is suggesting is that this beast has some of the characteristics of the beasts that are identified for you in Daniel 7. The Babylonian cruelty, the Medo-Persian cruelty, the Greek and Seleucid cruelties. It's partly leopard, partly lion, partly bear. Do you see? It's got part of all of them, but this is another beast. And the dragon gives this beast particular power and throne and great authority. What this suggests then is that the symbolism drawn from Daniel's vision in Daniel 7 makes a kind of twofold point. First, the beast of the sea embodies all the evil of previous empires, which in John's perspective meet in Rome. And second, the beast's authority is, finally, derived from Satan. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. Now, before we press on with the chapter, it's important to think through what this means. If the beast recurs, if the beast recurred even in the first century, yet there are beasts beyond Rome. If Antichrist comes at the end, but there are Antichrists who come in anticipation of the end. If these are concrete historical personages, but with the authority of the devil behind them. This means that when a Pope Innocent III erupts, or a Hitler erupts, or an Idi Amin erupts, or a Stalin erupts, from a theological perspective, as he hurls all his weight and cruelty against all that is good and right, and not least against the Church, what you see is the concretizing in history of the power of Satan himself coming again against Christ, often trying to claim the authority of Christ, antichrists afresh in anticipation of the final antichrist, again and again and again and again. And again and again and again, he receives a fatal wound. And the people rejoice, and then they're astonished that he springs back to life again. Isn't that what happened at the end of World War I? The war to end all wars. Then there was World War II. And now, of course, with the Cold War theoretically dead, you have all kinds of people saying conflict has ended in history, and one person actually wrote a book that history now is at an end. Got wonderful reviews in New York Times Review of Books. It's an idiotic thesis. I don't know what else to say. I mean, you really have to be smart to be that stupid. I don't know what else to say. In any case, from God's perspective, until the final Antichrist comes, there will be Antichrists. And just when we think he's dead, he comes back to life. I don't pretend to know what's going to happen in the next 5 years, let alone the next 50 or 100. But if the Lord tarries, I'll guarantee this, there'll be more war. A lot more war. A lot more suffering. Bloody revolution. More persecution. Because Antichrist keeps coming back. You give him a fatal wound, and everybody says, aha. And then he comes back, and everybody says, oh, you can't beat him, can you? And then everybody joins him. It has been a regular pattern in history. Thus, Satan takes over the legitimate interests of the state until the state becomes Satan's toy to oppose Christ. Verses 3 and 4, you have this fatal wound, and some people have tried to tie this with a particular Roman emperor. That is true. Nero committed suicide, probably, in AD 68. And he was so evil that there arose after him a Nero Redivivus, Nero coming back to life, myth. And some people think that that's what John is referring to. But John is not so superstitious. He just isn't so superstitious. The point is rather articulated down in verse 12 and in verse 14 with respect to the second beast, who brings honor to the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed, verse 12. Verse 14, he ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. In other words, he receives a fatal wound, but the beast surprisingly lives. People are constantly surprised at the survivability of raw evil. Verse 4, men worship the dragon because he had been given authority to the beast, and they also worship the beast and ask, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Isn't that what many, many well-meaning people have said under various totalitarian regimes of left and right? You can't fight the state. It's just too powerful. Well, you could fight it the way Bonhoeffer did, but he paid for it with his life. Or again, you see, the same sort of notion appears in chapter 17, verse 8. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. They're astonished when he comes back again. Do you see? That is what astonishes them. They think that they've won. They think they've put him down. He's gone. He receives the fatal wound, and then he comes back again. They're astonished. From the beginning of history, pagan and immoral states have sometimes risen in violent evil against God's people. They receive, eventually, mighty death blows. Blows finally from God, but the evil returns. Pharaoh in Egypt. Mighty Assyria. Met any Assyrians recently? Empire's wiped out. There's a small handful of them, a couple of little villages. That's it. Babylon. Rome. Hitler with his thousand-year Reich. And shall our culture survive if it squeezes God to the periphery and worships self and things and success and money and sports and media personalities? Another form of beast. Antichrist comes in many forms. 1 John 2:18, even so there are many antichrists. But when the antichrist comes, then many people say, now what's the use? Chapter 13, verse 4. Who can fight this one? Even the question that they ask in 13:4 is really a parody of Old Testament language. For example, Exodus 15:11, who among the gods is like you, O Lord? But they ask, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Do you see? He can be brutal. Look at all the crowns on his horns. But the point to be observed from all of this, it seems to me, is this. The power of Satan expresses itself in antichrists, in concrete, historical opposition to God's people. Second, antichrist is full of blasphemy. Look at the end of verse 1. And on each head a blasphemous name. Now, at one level, of course, this language is tied to the tendency of Roman emperors to take divine names on themselves, which would inevitably be a great offense to genuine believers. Augustus was proclaimed Divus, D-I-V-U-S, Divus, one like the gods, even in his lifetime. Nero was called Savior of the World on his coins, Savior of the World. For Christians, there's only one Savior of the World. That's a biblical title. It's found in John chapter 4. The Roman Senate from Augustus on regularly declared the deceased emperors to be divine. Domitian, who I think is on the throne in John's day, was addressed in Latin as Dominus et Deus Noster. For you Latin people who did a bit of Latin when you were in school, what does that mean? Dominus et Deus Noster. Our Lord and God. My father taught me, Latin is a dead language, as dead can be. It killed all the Romans, and now it's killing me. He also taught me to conjugate verbs, you know, in amo, amas, amat, and so forth. So he said, amo, amas, I loved a lass, and she was tall and slender. Amas, amat, she laid me flat. Beware the feminine gender. So, you see, I got my introduction to Latin very early on. So if you have, then, Domitian being addressed, Dominus et Deus Noster, our Lord and our God, how would Christians view that, do you see? But the issue is larger than the vulgar blasphemy of Roman emperors. Look at verses 5 and 6. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. That is the whole period of this time of sharp opposition against God's people. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. Now the model again is the supreme blasphemer, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Remember how he blasphemed? By desecrating the temple, by putting a pig in the place of a lamb, by making it a capital offense to worship God at all. One remembers then 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4. The one who comes opposes and exalts himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, and even sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. I think that the way this works is, after the first clause, the unpacking of what it means to blaspheme God is sorted out in the next clauses. So thus you have, he was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and so on. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God. Now, what does it mean to blaspheme God? It means to slander God, is what the verb means, to slander God. To slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. His name, that is all that he is as represented by his name. It's not mere profanity, although it includes profanity, but it means anything that you can do to make a joke about God or to cut him down to size or to make him just like you, or to make him evil, or to laugh at him. Anything that demeans him, anything that slanders him, anything that depreciates him, to make him just a loving, fuddy-duddy old grandfather, or to make him a horrific hater of people. That's all slandering God, because it is presenting a God other than the God who is there. It is to slander God. To misrepresent him is to slander him. And his dwelling place, that is everything associated with his abode, with heaven, with holiness, with the ultimate goal, anything that depreciates that, instead, you live now. And those who live in heaven. Probably a reference not only to angels, but to the people of God who join him there. Hebrews chapter 12, 22. You have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. When I was a boy in high school, in the town of Drummondville, about 40,000 people in the province of Quebec, in the eastern townships, the town itself was about 97% French. And on the street, we spoke French. The church was bilingual. I got a part-time job after school, and that was all in French and so on. But in fact, I did go to an English school. Now, the English school had French every day, and some stuff was taught in French, but it was more English than French. And therefore, in a town of 40,000 with only a 3 or 4% English-speaking population, inevitably, the school was small. We went all the way from one to high school with only about 280 students or something. And so it was quite a small school. And this meant that we didn't have the best band programs in the world and all the optional extras that you get in the posh schools today. And you don't always attract the best teachers to those things either, although it was an earlier generation where there was a higher percentage of good teachers around, I sometimes think, than today. But we did have, in the Lord's mercy, we did have, during much of my time there, two very extraordinary school principals who tended to really put time into students who were excelling. I mean, they pull them aside and talk with them and push them and challenge them and chivy them along and so on. I had, the first one was a Mr. Lindsay. He taught history. He was an extraordinary man. He gave me a desire to teach and to read history and so on that very few people have given me. The next man who was there when I graduated was, he looked like a big fat slob, but he had a mind like a steel trap and knew how to discipline, knew how to keep things running, and was one of the best teachers of English literature I've ever sat under. And he was in those days where he would come in and he'd say things like, well, of course, any student worth anything in this class will automatically memorize a quarter to a third of all the poetry we read. It was just expected. Now, I didn't quite manage it, but I got awfully close just because this guy set the standards and expected us to do it. And he could ream endless of it himself. Every day or two, we'd have a page of poetry to memorize. And every once in a while, he'd spring it on you, too. He'd say, all right, Abu Ben Adam by the next day. That was about a page and a half or 2 pages, you see. And then he'd suddenly pick you up and say, all right, today we're going to have recitation. Carson, Abu Ben Adam. And you start, Abu Ben Adam make his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace and saw within the presence. And so as you go on and on and on, and you say, sit down, next. And you start, just keep going, you see? That was the kind of standards that you had in those days. And somehow or other, he took a shine to me and pulled me into his office after school every once in a while. In those days, there were no school buses. A small enough town, we walked or rode our bicycles. And we'd talk. He'd just talk. We'd tell jokes, and he'd tell about his time in World War II and what graduate school was like and imagination and fire and so on. He wasn't a Christian at all. He knew that my father was a Baptist minister. But he was an interesting, sparkling man who got me going on things. We'd debate and stuff. And one day we were talking along, and I partly because he was paying me attention, you know, when you're 15 or 16, you're at the center of the universe. And because he was paying me attention, he was fostering this view that I was center of the universe. And then one day we were talking after school in his office, and we were joking about this or that. I don't even remember what. And he said something to me. You know, I think that there's nothing too high and mighty that you can't joke about. Do you? Have you ever had some of those moments in your experience, moments of serendipity? That is, moment aha experiences. You know, where you think, aha, I see now. That was one of my aha experiences, a moment of serendipity. I liked the man, but for the first time, I mean, my father tried to warn me a little bit and say, well, try to think through the kind of framework out of which he's arguing. It's not just individual arguments, but a framework, a whole worldview that you're dealing with.
And suddenly I saw it. And behind the man I saw a beast. Nothing too high, nothing too mighty that you can't laugh at and malign God and his name and his throne and his heaven. Nothing? Isn't that another way of saying that you are God? It's very important to see then that these blasphemies and so on are very comprehensive. Antichrist is full of blasphemy. The whole question is one of who is in charge, who is doing the assessing. Do we stand back and poke fun at others, including God? Or is God in charge of us? Third, Antichrist commands wide allegiance. We've already looked at verses 3b and 4, and notice the breadth of allegiance there. Now 7b and 8. He was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. Now, do you see that? Now you're getting this setup that becomes stronger and stronger and stronger into chapter 14. You get either the people that are lined up with the beast or the people that are lined up with the Lamb. There are only two groups here. At the end of the day, this beast is worshipped by everybody except for one group. These are not the peculiarly awful people. These are not the particularly miserable customers in society. This is everybody, except for those who are in the Lamb's Book of Life. In one sense, the formula in 7b, people from every tongue and tribe and people and nation, apes the extent of the gospel that we saw in chapter 5, where again, you see, the gospel is proclaimed and Christ draws men and women from every language and tongue and tribe and people, or every tongue and tribe and people and nation and so on. You see? In one sense, again, there is an aping of that. But verse 8 makes one exception, namely those who do not, those whose names are in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, at one level, again, this is understandable, especially in totalitarian regimes. Whenever you have a totalitarian regime, a really truly totalitarian regime, what they really want is absolute conformity, don't they? That's what they want. I don't care whether it's a totalitarian regime of the left or of the right. That's what they want. It was true in the Roman Empire. It was true in Nazism. It's true in communist totalitarianism. It doesn't really make much difference. But there is a way in a democratic society that you can have a kind of totalitarianism without imposition of absolute authority. The worship of a satanically inspired perversion of secular authority is still an ultimate offense against the one true God. If at the end of the day, the demand of all of society is to worship pluralism as a philosophy, or to worship self-fulfillment as a society, or to adopt a therapeutic model in which the whole universe exists to meet my needs. There was a time, you know, when need was a verb, not a noun. I need something. Now I have needs. We've seen that before. So there are ways of distorting whole plausibility structures of the way people think, until finally Antichrist commands extraordinarily wide allegiance. Then, fourth, Antichrist causes great suffering among the people of God. Look at verse 9. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear. I suspect in this context, it's not so much saying, now you need to reflect about this, it's a strong now hear this. I think that is correct. Listen to this now. If you got any sense at all, if you're listening at all, hear this. If you got any sort of ear, listen. What do you listen? Two, if anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. Now, it's very important to recognize that this is within the context of chapter 12. Remember in chapter 12, the other children of the woman fly into the desert. The desert on the one place is the place of testing and all of that, preparatory to getting the promised land. On the other place is on the other hand, God does protect his people. But now the question arises, does this mean that the protection is such that they really won't suffer anything? Not according to this verse. According to this verse, a lot of them are going to get killed. So it begins to raise a theme that becomes stronger and stronger and stronger as the book goes along. It's been hinted at several times already. It gets stronger and stronger now as the book goes along. Namely, Are we being protected from such things or protected in such things? If you're protected from such things, then ultimately they don't happen to you. If you're protected in such things, then you may suffer them and you may endure them, but you persevere and hang on and are faithful even while you suffer. Now, the Lord may spare us from all kinds of things as well, but at the end of the day, what you discover is that a great deal of the faithfulness in this book that is called for is faithfulness to persevere in there right in the midst of suffering. It gets stronger and stronger, a theme. And you have to remember that that sort of theme is a common one in the New Testament. Very often people quote, more than conquerors. Where does that phrase come from? Romans 8. But when we use it, often more than conquerors means something like, oh, I can live above it all. There are those Christians down there who get stuck in the muck every once in a while, but I'm more than a conqueror. But in the context of Romans chapter 8, it's in the context of being harried like sheep, of being persecuted all day long, of being martyred, of being opposed, of being persecuted, trashed. No, but in all of these things, we are more than conquerors through Christ who loved us. In all these things? In that sense, the conquering has to do with persevering, being willing to face persecution and death. In other words, more than conquer has nothing to do with our psychological comfort zones. Being able to live this, quote, Victorian Christian life, unquote, while everybody else is down there in sort of second-tier Christianity? The precise shape of more than conquer depends a great deal on the particular temptations that we're called upon to suffer. But in this context, in chapter 13, the kind of afflictions this beast lashes out upon the people of God are first and foremost in terms of concrete, physical, malicious opposition that lead to martyrdom and death. And the proper response? This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints, and not less than both. Faithfulness, yes, but that could be fickle faith, last for a while and be faithful for a while and not endure. But it's supposed to be patient endurance as well. You endure and you are patient in it. It is a prolonged effort. But there are forms of patient endurance that are merely stoical. No. This must be a faithful patient endurance. Do you see? Not less than both. That's what it calls for. Thus, at the end of the day, humanity is here divided, especially verse 8, between those belonging to the Lamb who was slain and those who follow the beast who slays, and the dragon that he serves. There is a fantastic contrast between the two leaders, the beast and the Antichrist. The lamb who was slain from the creation of the world, verse 8. And he is the one we must follow precisely because we're prepared to die. We follow a lamb who was slain. Now we turn to the second beast. We'll go more quickly through the second beast before we take a break. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. Better, it is a man's number. I think it should be rendered. His number is 666. Now, what does this mean? Well, we've seen the beast out of the sea. Now we have the beast out of the earth. At first appearance, he is less daunting than the first beast. Nothing here about gruesome and grotesque horns and so forth. But on closer inspection, his danger comes from his immense power to deceive.
The first beast is engaged in outright opposition. The second beast is given to deception. Once again, I think it will be helpful to break up the text into 5 points. First, the power of Satan expresses itself in false prophets, plural, in concrete, historical deception. Repeat. The power of Satan expresses itself in false prophets, in concrete historical deception. Now again, once again, it is important to identify this beast. First, he comes out of the earth. Clearly a contrast to 13:1, the beast who comes out of the sea. Some have suggested that this means local opposition as opposed to Roman opposition, which could easily come from across the sea. The Romans often transported their troops across the Mediterranean Sea. So this would be local opposition. Stuff grown on your home turf, as it were. But I think that just won't work. After all, there are many parts of the Roman Empire that were served by Roman roads rather than by boats. That's why the Romans built the roads, so they could have rapid communications and could move their armies in a big hurry. In any case, the fundamental difference between the two beasts is not their geographical provenance. No, I think that the likely symbolism arises from three other factors. First, some Jewish apocalyptic spoke of two primeval monsters. 1 Enoch 60, if you want to read a source, verses 7 to 10. Leviathan, who lives in the abysses of the ocean, and Behemoth. Leviathan is female, Behemoth is male, living in waste wilderness named Duodane, you get in Jewish apocalyptic, that sort of thing. These primeval monsters become symbols for all that is evil and vile and chaotic and malicious. And I think that the apocalyptist is using that kind of heritage, this form of literary expression. More important, do you recall that we're told in chapter 12 that the beast is cast down to the earth? Chapter 12, verse 12, rejoice you heavens. That is because Satan has been thrown out, as we saw earlier. Verse 9, he was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. He's hurled down, verse 9, out of heaven. He lost his space in heaven, verse 8. Do you see? Therefore, verse 12, rejoice you heavens and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea. That is the whole human domain, the earth and the sea. And so now you have a beast coming out of each of them. So part of this double beast, you know, coming out from the earth and from the sea, is merely a reflection of the language that's already established for you in chapter 12. And then in the third place, and perhaps this is the most important, we've already seen that for landlubbers like the Jews, the sea was a symbolism for chaos, for movement, for restlessness, for upheaval. So a beast coming out of the sea carries with it that kind of overtone. But unless you live in California, the land normally signals stability. See, the beast here comes in a way that does not seem to threaten. That's the very nature of stability. If you're in the midst of a surging sea, you're not too surprised if there's a storm now and then. You're always surprised by an earthquake. The land is supposed to be stable. The Japanese built for it. But it wasn't stable enough. In other words, this is a kind of platform for stability, which is the very foundation of all deception. In other words, it seems to me this is peculiarly appropriate symbolism when the chief function of the second beast is to deceive. That, I think, is what brings us to the heart of the matter. This beast is the satanically inspired power to deceive men and women, manifesting itself in concrete historical experiences. Thus, 14a. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Look at the two horns of a lamb in verse 11. Here, it's not a question of kingly authority. The image, rather, is of gentleness, of harmlessness. A nice lamb, cuddly, just growing horns, thank you. And suddenly, then, you remember some of the other biblical passages. Matthew 7:15, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. Do you see? Or again, the devil may go about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, but he may go about as an angel of light, deceiving, if it were possible, the very elect. The beast speaks like a dragon, we're told. This does not mean, in the light of the entire picture, that he roars like a dragon, because then he wouldn't be deceiving anybody. The point is, he's the dragon's mouthpiece. Elsewhere in this book, now once again you have a situation where you can unpack the meaning of this symbolism by later in the book. And this, it seems to me, is the clincher that this line of interpretation just has to be right. Look at 16:13. Then I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs. Well, we'll forget the frogs for a moment. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, that's the first beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, that's the second beast. Or again, chapter 19, verse 20. But the beast, that's the first beast, was captured, and with him the false prophet who had performed the miraculous signs on his behalf. With these signs he had deluded those who had received the mark of the beast. Do you see? The second beast is identified again as the false prophet. Or again in chapter 20, verse 10, the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. Now the very terminology, false prophet, suggests deception. Doesn't it? What else can that mean? In other words, there are times when Satan doesn't come to us and say, here is a great big packet of heretical teaching. Go ahead. Believe it. Satan's not stupid. How is he likely to come? Isn't he more likely to come and say, well, I know that quite a few people have thought that, but there are some disadvantages from several points of view. Across the reaches of church history, there have been others who've taken another point of view. For example, you should really read the readings of Origen, for example, on the nature of the soul. He'll help you a great deal in this regard. Well, there are some people who do think that hell continues to exist, but there's some very godly people, you know, who actually believe in annihilationism. You die, and then you face your punishment, and then ultimately you are annihilated. Some very godly people have held that view. Some very godly people do hold that view, in all sincerity. And yes, it's right to believe that Jesus is divine. I mean, he is unique and is to be honored in many ways. But of course, we all are image bearers, aren't we? We all have something of the spark of the divine in us, in that doesn't the Bible call all of us God's image bearers? He's one with us and walk this dusty path. Part of the problem, of course, is that too many Christians have so emphasized his deity that we've forgotten his humanity. If you begin with a Christology from below, you see, you really are much more likely to appeal to the common person on the street. And after all, you do want to appeal in the gospel to the common person on the street, don't you? And of course, you have to say yes, 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 because it's the only answer a thinking Christian can say. But if you're a thinking Christian who's alert, you might also want to say some yes buts now and then. Listen. At no time in the history of the church has the church moved holus bolus from truth to flat-out heresy in one step. Never. Never, 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 never. It always takes a little squidgen, a little piece, opening up to other things. In the history of North America seminaries, often there has been an attempt to at least be broad-minded enough to let some people who have a slightly broader view in of the authority of Scripture or the person of Christ, or maybe they don't believe in substitution, but they do believe Christ's death is really strategic and important, at least. So you're becoming just a little more tolerant. I mean, you don't want to be intolerant, do you? I mean, that's narrow and bigoted and right-wing and merely modernist, not postmodernist, and all the rest. Yes, yes, and there's a sense in which you don't want to be right-wing and reactionary and heresy-hunting and all of that. Yet by the time most of those are in control, they don't want you there. That has been the history of North American seminaries. They squeeze you out. And then they've got the seminary, and the books, and the endowments, and the students, and the whole denomination gets shot. And only in a handful of cases has it been possible to retrieve anything. Now, again, I don't want to start a heresy hunt or anything, too, because there are some people on the far right wing that are they're defined negatively. You know them only by what they're against. They have nothing positive to say. They don't contend for the faith. They're contentious about the faith. They're just nasty people. What else can you say? There's not a trace of compassion in them. They don't weep over the city. They're just a nasty piece of work, and they call it faithfulness. But the very fact that they exist also makes it easy for the devil to come along and say, you don't want to be like that, do you? and you end up so spongy that you have no spinal cord left at all. The devil is not stupid. What that means then, brothers and sisters in Christ, is that every generation is in danger of skewing things. It's very easy to spot the heresies in some other generation. We all think that we are very terribly perceptive in ours. But the truth of the matter is the overwhelming majority of us really aren't. We're too busy fighting yesterday's fights in yesterday's categories. And the only thing that I can think of that will even begin to guard us against this kind of thing is the kind of prayerful, humble, repeated rereading and rereading and rereading and rereading and rereading and rereading of Scripture so that we really do think God's thoughts after Him. And even then we can be self-deceived. But it's a first step. It's a first step. Now notice carefully then. In the second place, the false prophet serves Antichrist, who serves Satan, an unholy triumvirate. We saw that the first beast received his authority from Satan. The second beast, the false prophet, serves Antichrist. And Antichrist, we've seen, serves Satan. So now you've got an unholy triumvirate, a kind of foil, a kind of aping of the Trinity. He exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence, is what is really meant on his behalf, in his presence, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, which we've already seen from the previous part of the chapter, which is the same thing as worshiping Satan. Now the language, in fact, is again redolent of the relationships amongst the persons of the Godhead. According to Matthew chapter 11, verse 27, and again, especially in the fourth gospel, the Son receives authority from His Father to say and do certain things. There is a functional subordination in the Bible of the Son to the Father. The Son says only what the Father gives Him to say. The Son does only what the Father gives Him to do. There is a functional subordination of the eternal Son to the eternal Father. And then the Holy Spirit comes along and is sent by the Father and the Son. Thus there is an economic subordination within the triune God. So there's a subordination here too. The Antichrist is from Satan, Revelation 13:4. And as the Holy Spirit then glorifies Christ, John 16:4, so the false prophet glorifies the Antichrist. Here, an unholy trinity, if you like, an unholy triumvirate, aping God, as it were. Now, I think that there are two things to learn from this second point. First, that which opposes God often does so by surreptitiously trying to take God's place. That which opposes God may not do so from an external atheistic perspective, as in a totalitarian regime that is controlled by a philosophical materialism. It may try to take God's perspective. That is why in the New Testament idolatry is defined as covetousness in Colossians. Because in covetousness, you want something so badly that it dominates your mind. You see, that's what you think about, that's what you gravitate toward, that's what you dream of. If you dream of it all the time, that's what you gravitate toward, that's what you can't live without, that's your God. So it's a form of idolatry. It's not for nothing that the first and the last of the Ten Commandments begin, "You shall have no other God before me," and the last one is, "You shall not be covetous." Because the two are the flip side, one of the other. Do you see? There's a kind of literary inclusio in the Ten Commandments. Both have to do with the godhood of God. Do you remember how 1 John begins? See, I'm persuaded that John thinks very deeply about these things. Remember how 1 John argues, offering three tests, perhaps four, for genuine spirituality and godliness and orthodoxy and so on. He works through, you know, the importance of love and the importance of obedience and so on. You get all through the whole thing, clearly in my view, responding to the proto-Gnostic heresy at the end of the first century. You get through the very last line of the very last chapter, the last verse, 1 John 5:21. Remember how the epistle ends? "My little children, keep..." That's right. Exactly right. "My little children, keep yourself from idols." Well, you look at this thing, where does this come from? He hasn't been talking about idols. He hasn't mentioned idols the whole thing. In fact, there are all kinds of literary critics who will say that this was put in by some late redactor, didn't know what he was doing, and so on. John thinks very profoundly. What he's saying is, if you have a form of Christianity where you don't love one another, if you have a form of Christianity
where you don't confess that Jesus Christ is God come in the flesh. If you have a form of Christianity that does not obey, you are in idolatry. It's not the real Jesus. It's not the real Christianity. It's idolatry. My little children, keep yourself from idols. Do you see? John thinks very profoundly about these things. The Jehovah's Witnesses, after all, have a Christ. They have a Christ. And in some ways, he's the same as yours, isn't he? I mean, they believe he was born in Bethlehem, that his mother was Mary, that his father wasn't the real father, that he was actually begotten by God, and so on. They believe all these things. Isn't he the same as your Christ? But it turns out that he's not, even though he has many points of parallel. Eventually, you have to say, keep yourself from idols, because the construction isn't the same as the Christ of the Bible. Do you see? The second thing to observe from this is that Satan may use quite different forms of evil to reinforce one another to achieve his main aim. You know, these programs, these cop shows on TV, they try to show you what they say is true in real life. I haven't spent enough time in police stations to know for sure, where they have sort of a good cop, bad cop routine. One ugly-looking cop is threatening to beat you around if you don't sort of cooperate, and the other cop is pretending to be a good cop and sort of saying, hey, you just back off, you know. This fellow's going to help us, isn't he? Well, I'll go and get you a cup of coffee, and it's all smooth. And the idea is he's supposed to win your confidence, you see, and hey, I can't really help you against this brute unless you give me something for him, you see. So the good cop, bad cop routine plays out. The point to remember in the good cop, bad cop routine is that both cops are after the same thing. So the thing that you have to remember in the first beast, second beast routine is that they're both after the same thing. That's the point. See, one may proceed by persecution, scare the pants off some people, make them throw things over. The other one achieves by being open-minded and deceiving you and this sort of thing. You see, but they're after the same thing. They still want you to worship the same beast, who's still controlled by the same being, namely Satan. And if you don't see that, you're going to get seduced. It's as simple as that. You just got snookered by the good cop. Which brings me to the focal point, point three. The false prophet is full of deceptive power. Now, just as at the end of chapter 12, verses 13 and following, we saw that the language used to describe the dragon going after the woman and her other offspring is full of language drawn from the Exodus, out in the desert, and so on, the eagle saving her, and so on. It's drawn from that. So now, some of the language is drawn from Elijah, the forerunner. Look at verses 13 and 14. He performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. That, of course, sounds very much like Elijah. F.F. Bruce describes him as the minister of propaganda for the Antichrist, because we're told of him, because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Look at verses 14b and 15. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and call all who refused to worship the image to be killed. Well, there was common belief in the ancient world that certain statues spoke. That was a not uncommon belief. In Chicago, in one of the Catholic churches, there is a statue that is often said to weep. I'd love to examine it closely myself. Certainly in the ancient world, ventriloquism was common enough too. Apollonius of Tyana, who was one of the great shysters of the ancient world, that was his age. Apelles of Ascalon was at home in the courts of Caligula, for example. So the sorcerer Elymas on Cyprus in Acts chapter 13 went about deceiving various people, trying to control the governor by his sorcery. It was the age of black magic, of astrology, of all kinds of manipulation. And what was actually demonic, and what was just trick, and what was just psychological, you can't always untangle it. You don't need to if you're a Christian. What is clear is that there are repeated historical patterns of deception culminating finally in the false prophet at the time of the ultimate Antichrist. You see, if the second beast serves the first beast, if the false prophet serves the Antichrist, and Antichrist comes along in various historical personages up to the ultimate Antichrist, this means correspondingly that the power of deception, the second beast, must come along in various historical periods again and again and again, you see, in various ways.
Now, we need, I think, to think about this question of religious and moral deception more holistically than we sometimes do. Did you see the exposure in Bill Moyer 4 or 5 years ago of the evangelist in California by the name of Popoff? Did some of you see that program? Yeah? Well, let me tell you about it, because most of you obviously haven't. Popoff was one of these evangelists, a healing-type evangelist in Southern California, who brought in the crowds and a lot of money. He had a particular shtick. He would be up there claiming to hear the voice of God, and he'd say, "There is a woman by the name of Brown in row 13, seat G. Your problem is," and he'd name the actual problem and tell her to come forward, you see. Then he'd lay hands on her, and she'd fall or not, and many reported healings, and so on, so on, so on. But this ability to just pick people out like that, you see, and have them come forward. And he'd be right. But some of his critics noticed that he wore an earphone, or at least a hearing aid, apparently. Now, a healer with a hearing aid doesn't necessarily mean anything, but you have to at least ask the question. So somebody went in there with a radio scanner. Now, a radio scanner is a reception device that scans all frequencies within certain bands, going back and forth, and will stop at the strongest frequency that's around, you see, until you tell it to go on. And it turned out that what happened is when people were coming in, they were asked to fill out little prayer cards so that the staff would pray for you, put on your name, and it was often Popoff's wife that picked them in at the counter. And when she saw a suitable one, you know, it wasn't sort of, "I'm in my last degree of cancer, getting ready to die, I won't live longer than 3 weeks." Well, that one doesn't get anything. But someone with back pain or someone with one of these things that's got a pretty good chance of being at least partially psychosomatic, that one will handle. And then she'd watch where the person would go and sit, make a little note on the card. And once everybody was seated, she had a little radio. And the thing in Popoff's ear was not a hearing aid, it was a radio receiver. You see? So what happened was the people, the Moyer and his crew, they were taping this all in secret, what was going on, you see, and hearing Popoff, but the scanner was picking up the little voice from Mrs. Popoff. And then they just put the two together in real time and played it on the air. Now, the thing to point out, now, Popoff's now out of business, thank God. But the point to recognize in all of this is that the overwhelming majority of those who supported Popoff were some brand or other of evangelical or charismatic. Don't kid yourself. The overwhelming majority. Now, again, do not misunderstand me. I am not a cessationist. I am not trying to teach that there's no real healing today. I'm not for a moment arguing that it's wrong to pray for the sick or that God doesn't or can't heal. I'm saying that we live in an age that just loves displays of power, and we can't get enough of it. We intoxicate ourselves on it. And we think that that's more significant than seeing someone born out of the kingdom of darkness and into the kingdom of God's dear Son. It's appalling. And so as a result, we have an overwhelmingly high percentage of claims that are outrageous, and some out-and-out shysters. In any case, even where there's not a shysterism going on, the focus is wrong. It detracts us from what lies at the very center. In other words, there can be a power of deception to divert attention rather than to deny the foundations. If I were Satan going after a church, I wouldn't start off by denying the truthfulness of Scripture. I wouldn't start off by damning Christ. I wouldn't start off by denying substitutionary atonement. I'd start off by diversions. Break down the associations between blessings and the cross. Break down the associations between the blessings and self-denial. Talk more and more about power and less about self-denial. Talk more and more about the blessings that come from the Spirit, abstracted from the cross which alone provides the Spirit. And on and on and on, until you break down the associational links that tie things to that which is at the center. After you've done that for one generation, the next generation, you can take them right off into heresy. It's as easy as pie. It's been done again and again. And the result is that we have shoved a whole culture along. It's not just within evangelicalism. We have shoved a whole culture along. During the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in one of his radio fireside chats that he had, most here aren't old enough to remember those fireside chats, but yeah, he was the one who started the mass media. Before him, there was no president that got on the radio regularly, you see, let alone television. He'd have these fireside chats to let you know what was going on. And at the height of the Great Depression, one of his famous lines was, "Our troubles, thank God, are only material." Can you imagine Clinton saying that? Or Reagan? Or Kennedy? Or Johnson? Or Carter? Or anybody? You'd be impeached. And that reflects, you see, such a difference in worldview in just 60 years. It's just a fantastic difference in worldview. And it's all come about bit by bit, bit by bit, bit by bit, you see? In other words, naturalism teaches that the ultimately important things are just things. The acquisition of things signals success. There is an assumption of human goodness. When the founding fathers wrote the Constitution of this country, whether they were deists or theists, one of the things they believed in formidably, to a man, was that human nature is depraved. And the reason why they wanted a democracy was so that you could turf the blighters out every so often. They saw democracy as merely a way of not letting too much power get into any one person's hand for too long. A way, finally, of stopping too much evil accumulating in one person. They believed what Lord Acton said in Britain the century before. All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We don't believe that today. We so believe in goodness, you see, that as a result, politician after politician after politician from every party and in every Western democratic nation speaks of the great wisdom of the X people in this country, American, in Canada, Canadian, in Britain, British, whatever. Do you see? The great wisdom of the American people? Thomas Jefferson thought that? You've got to be joking. He didn't think anything of the kind. He just wanted to make sure that all the sinners amongst the American people had a way of getting out corrupt sinners who were powerful at the top. You see, but nobody believes that today. It's all gone. Spirituality is one of the in things today. And so one could go on. I don't want to spend the whole time becoming depressed about the various forms of deception that are around. In the moral arena, so much parades itself as moral, from the left and the right, that at the end of the day is just profoundly self-seeking. From the left and the right. And meanwhile, the fundamental questions of morality that are bound up with the character of God and what he demands, that's good. The character of God and therefore what he prohibits, that's bad. All of that's lost. All of that's gone. But that was the common worldview in the antebellum period in this country. It's very important to understand then that the false prophet is full of deceptive power, and we have moved generation by generation away from the kind of base that was here at the beginning in terms of worldview. And if we're going to begin to claw back by the mercies of God and reformation and revival and teaching and preaching, it must be worldview preaching and teaching. It must be holistic. It must embrace everything. Absolutely everything. Fourth, the false prophet demands conformity, verses 15 to 17. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and so on. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. You see? An economic boycott here. All kinds of backgrounds have been suggested. The obvious point is the parody of the sealing of the elect that we saw in Revelation chapter 7. Chapter 7, all of God's people have a mark put on them. Now, the beast has a mark on all of his people. And then, in case you've missed that contrast, it comes back again in chapter 14, verse 1. All the people who have the name of the Lamb on them and his Father's name written on their foreheads. Now you've got everybody in the world, you see, with either the mark of the beast or the mark of the Lamb. Now, clearly, in chapter 13 here at the end, the mark of the beast is put on some people so that they escape the wrath of the beast. Everybody who doesn't have the mark of the beast, you see, has to face the wrath of the beast. But we saw in chapter 7, we will see again at the beginning of chapter 14, that if you have the mark of the Lamb, you don't have to face the Lamb's wrath. So now we see something that I've hinted at again and again and again in the book, and now it's coming to clear-sighted expression. You either have the mark of the beast and face the wrath of the Lamb, or you have the mark of the Lamb and you face the wrath of the beast. But you're going to have some mark, and you're going to face some wrath. The question is, whose mark and whose wrath? Historically, of course, pressure came again and again and again from the imperial cult. The official policy was to make refusal to worship the emperor a capital offense. And if you were in the Roman Empire, then you had to worship the emperor, you were treasonous. Now then, do I need to say something about 666? Let's take a break. And then I'll say something about 666.